Shalom Hadavarnix, Shalom Talmidim. Welcome to our next session in the study of the 12 minor prophets. We are currently beginning session number 6 in the book of Hosea, going through the material provided for us by Ariel Ministries. So let's take a quick review of where we were last session. Last session we finished up some time in the kingdom in chapter 2, verse 1, and then Hosea jumped all the way back to his present time, over thousands of years, to chapter 2, verse 2, and the prophet's present time. After spending one verse there, he jumped to the near future, which was 722 BC, and the prediction of the Assyrian destruction of the northern kingdom in verses 3 through 13. Then another jump forward to the tribulation period in verses 14 and 15. Now, as we looked at verse 14, we noted the principle of the wooing in the wilderness. And I summarized that teaching on your slide. In the middle of the tribulation period, the majority of the Jewish people will flee persecution by the Antichrist. By going to a location outside of Israel that is a mountainous wilderness, Bozra, also known as Petra, in the Mount Seir mountain range that's located in modern southern Jordan. Once there, God will court Israel, woo Israel, and Israel will respond. And then I gave you some cross-references there at the bottom of the slide. Now, what we're talking about here is the campaign of Armageddon. And Hosea gives us a glimpse at the first 8 of 11 stages, the first 8 of 11 steps in the campaign of Armageddon. So let's review them very, very quickly. First of all, the first stage is the Antichrist's armies assemble at Armageddon. That's Armageddon is actually Har Megiddo. Har Megiddo is the mountain of Megiddo. It overlooks the Jezreel Valley. So there's where the Antichrist armies will assemble. This is a staging area. No battle will be fought at Har Megiddo, at the Valley of the Jezreel. But the armies will assemble there. That's the staging area. And so all the nations of the world will supply armament and troops and bring them into the Jezreel Valley. There's Jezreel Valley, a very, very important word in the book of Hosea, Jezreel, isn't it? Now, Babylon will be the religious, political, and economic capital of the world, the Antichrist capital. So the Antichrist, in stage 2, joins his troops. He leaves Babylon. He joins them probably in a headquarters located on the hill called Har Megiddo, the mountain of Megiddo. This brings us to the third stage, which is the destruction of Babylon. We learn in Jeremiah 51, 27, and 28 that the kingdoms of Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz all joined forces with another kingdom, with the Medes, and then turn into a surprise attack upon Babylon. And their surprise attack is swift and complete. Babylon is vaporized. It's destroyed in the manner that the Bible demands. And Babylon has never yet been destroyed so completely and suddenly as the Bible demands that it be destroyed. Well, that brings us now to the fourth stage, which is the fall of Jerusalem. The Antichrist does not defend his capital. He has something more important, and that is to destroy the Jewish people. So he moves south to Jerusalem. A horrendous battle occurs, but the IDF, for all their skill, are defeated and Jerusalem falls. This brings us to the fifth stage. The tribulation holocaust begins when the Antichrist now desecrates the temple. Desecrates the third temple, and the Jewish flight to Bozra or Petra begins. All the Jewish people that can escape to Bozra in Edom, modern southern Jordan today, the Mount Seir mountain range. Well, the sixth stage is the fact that the armies of the Antichrist then besiege Bozra. The Antichrist sets up a siege, and he begins to pound away at the Jewish community holed up in Bozra. After a 3.5-year siege, it appears that the Antichrist will eventually, and his armies will eventually win. And so our stubborn will is finally broken. And the seventh stage is the national regeneration of Israel. We begin to call out to Yeshua. We call out to Yeshua to save us. And that brings us to the eighth stage, the second coming of the Messiah. Yeshua responds, and he comes back to save his people. And the initial point of the second coming there is Bozra in the land of Edom. And again, if you would like some more information about this position on eschatology, I recommend the book Footsteps of the Messiah by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum, available through Ariel Ministries Press or Amazon.com. I feel this is the best book on eschatology and the book of Revelation prophecy that I have read. I've been exposed to a lot of stuff, but I always keep coming back to Arnold's position. It is the most consistent, most complete, most conservative, and non-speculative position out there. So I recommend it highly. Okay, we were in the tribulation period in verses 14 and 15. Now we move in verses 16 through 23 into the kingdom itself. And in verses 16 and 17 of Hosea chapter 2, we see that Israel will remove idolatry in preparation for entering the Messianic kingdom. Verses 16 and 17. It will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishi, and will no longer call me Baali. For I will remove the names of the Baals, the Baalim, from her mouth, so that they will be mentioned by their names no more. Well, why in the world would the Jewish people have to remove idolatry from their midst? The most commentators will tell you that idolatry was not a problem in Israel after the return from the Babylonian captivity for 70 years. Well, that might have been true in the beginning, but today, here's the situation that we find ourselves in. Here's a photograph that I scanned in from Biblical Archaeology Review a number of years ago. This happened up in the Golan Heights. And you see these ladies, these four ladies dancing, and they're dancing in front of this little clay statue. The caption reads, Potter Daphne Zuckerman replicated a clay figure thought to be that of a goddess. For about half an hour they danced while the leader recited a prayer thanking the goddess, not the god of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but the goddess of the forces for the forces of life, fertility, and peace. That came out of Biblical Archaeology Review, May and June 2001. What's the message? The message is, I'm back! Idolatry is back in Israel. And not only in 2001, here's an article in the Jerusalem Post in 2003, Meditation Goes Mainstream. So many Israelis go to India, and they learn Hindu practices and Hindu idol worship, and they come back to Israel and they continue those practices. Modern idolatry. And then there's Kabbalah, ultra-Orthodox mysticism. Now, if this isn't superstition and idolatry, I don't know what is. This was an article in 2004 in the Jerusalem Post. Parts of the article read, here's an excerpts from the article. For NIS 1200, that's New Israeli Shekel 1200, you can get a set of Zohar. What's the Zohar? The Zohar is a set of books here in the red circle. You can get a set of Zohar. If you don't buy now, you're giving the evil inclination a chance to influence you. Just a few drops of spiritual light from the Zohar will bring material plenty. Notice that manipulation. You know, if you don't do it now, the devil will get you. But if you do it now, you'll get rich. That's a nice carrot to hang out for people there, huh? The books don't even have to physically arrive at your house. The fact that you've bought them is enough. So once you click that go signal on the internet, and the books are in your shopping basket, and you say complete the transaction, yes, they're yours. You're getting all the benefits of the Zohar. That's worshiping the Zohar, isn't it? Now, the Kabbalists also have a lot of stuff for sale. They have silver and gold Kabbalah, healing power protection rings, and protection rings, and polo shirts with Kabbalah letters, and incense, and red thread. Why are they selling you red thread? Because that negates the evil eye. You go to Israel these days, You'll see these guys walking around with red threads trying to get you to put them around your wrist. I remember a trip I took over there with my brother, and all of a sudden he's walking beside me. He's got this red thread around his wrist. I said, "Why in the world do you get that thing?" "Well, this guy just put it on me." Well, you see, that's trusting superstition and not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There's Kabbalah water. How is Kabbalah water different? Well, it's got pristine molecules that are shaped like the Magen David, whatever that means. Regular water can create chaos, but this water provides protection. So you're trusting in Kabbalah water rather than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is idol worship, you guys. You can also get Pinchas water, which has medicinal qualities. And finally, you can buy amulets, 44 different types of amulets for health and finding a mate and fertility, and you see the whole list there. So that is just pure superstition, to be trusting in an amulet to take care of your financial success or your creativity or something like that. And then in 2004, here's a picture I scanned in from the Jerusalem Post on an article entitled Sage Worship. The headline read, "The Heavens Are Open." Here's an excerpt. Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Ifergan is tossing candles into the furnace. The candles are offerings to the tzaddikim. Offerings to the tzaddikim? Like sacrifices? Who are the tzaddikim? The righteous sages, so that they might intercede with God and answer the prayers of all those present. Because of the rabbi's efforts, the heavens are open. The tzaddikim are receiving our prayers, the MC shouts. So you're not praying directly to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as the Bible directs. You're praying to these sages. That is sage worship, idol worship. In the book Rejoice, O Youth, by Rabbi Avigdor Miller, and by the way, Rabbi Miller was considered one of the modern Gedolim, one of the modern great ones. He wrote this book, Rejoice, O Youth. But here are some excerpts from the book on pages 208 and 209. He says, "After the destruction of the sanctuary, the special presence of God, which once dwelt in the Holy of Holies, now rests on the sages who teach the Torah to disciples." That's the Talmud, Brachot 8a. The special presence of God would be the Shekinah glory. It dwelt in the Holy of Holies. But now the Shekinah glory rests on the sages. Well, let's learn about the importance of the sages. Even when the divine presence dwelt in the sanctuary, it was only because of the Torah sages anyway. They are the bond between God and Yisrael, because they bear the oral tradition for which God made his covenant with us. See the importance on the sages and oral tradition? This is idol worship, folks. Now, this is the most important phrase. Any form of contact with the sages and of support of the sages is tantamount, the same as, contact with God. These are men, folks. These are men. And they're dead men, by the way. So if you contact them, contact the dead, or somehow support the modern sages, it's the same as contact with God. That is flagrant idol worship. Now, of the believers in Yeshua, this is what Rabbi Miller had to say. He says, "The writings of the Nazarene's followers state clearly that all the sages of the Jews opposed them. Not even a single man of learning supported them." So they obviously can't be right if the sages didn't support them. The Nazarenes state also in their writings that their only adherents were some of the most ignorant and men and persons of the lowest class, the Am HaAretz. Those people. And even among those people, even among them, the vast majority opposed the Nazarenes. So the Nazarenes couldn't get anybody of any worth on their side. The writings of the Nazarene's followers concede that the sages rebuked him and his followers for violating the law of the Torah. And what they mean there is the oral law. Yeshua broke the oral law many, many times, but he never broke the Mosaic law, the written law. And it's the Mosaic law that comes down from God, and it is the oral law which is man's traditions. So I wrote up here my point. This is Rabbi Miller's point. His point: the Orthodox theology of sage worship justifies the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus in the first century and today. If the sages rejected him, they can't be wrong. If the sages rejected him, he must not be the Messiah, because the sages are holy and right. And right, I mean, they're like this with God. They're tight with God. So, though they can't be wrong. All righty. So idol worship will have to be removed from Israel for entrance into the Messianic kingdom. And so in that day, in the kingdom, God will no longer be called Baali. Now, Baali means my husband, in the sense of my master. Now, this is not a tender term. The emphasis is on ownership or possessor, my owner, my possessor. And you can see the usage of Baali in Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Proverbs there in your outline. Instead of calling God Baali, Israel will call God Ishi, my husband. Now, that's also my husband, but it's in the sense of my man, a much more affectionate term than Baali. Now, both terms are legitimate Hebrew terms for my husband in classical and modern Hebrew, but Baali sounds so much like Baal that it is removed from the vocabulary of the Hebrew language in the future, in the kingdom. Now, an example of a change in name like this is point E in your outline, a son of David. Baaliada, 1 Chronicles 14:7, literally means the Lord, the Master knows. It's a form of Baal. So that, because of Baal worship, the form of Baal was taken off it, and his name was shortened to Eliada in 2 Samuel 5:16, from the Lord, the Master knows, to God knows. Getting rid of that any inference of Baal there. Now, in the rabbinic writings, verse 16 is understood to be messianic. Hosea 2:16 in Midrash Rabbah of Exodus. Rabbi Levi said, God told Moses, let this be a sign to you. In the wilderness wilt thou leave them, and from the wilderness wilt thou bring them back in the messianic times. In the messianic times, Israel will come out of the wilderness. As it is said, therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness. And they quote Hosea 2:16 for the principle, for the biblical backup to that comment, our verse 16. Midrash Rabbah Ruth. The fifth interpretation makes it refer to the Messiah. Where will he lead them? So we see it's messianic from this rabbi's perspective. Where will he, the Messiah, lead them? From the land of Israel to the wilderness of Judah, as it is written, and he quotes our verse, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness. Also see Pasikta the Rab Kahana and Shemot Rabbah. So this is understood to be a very messianic verse that will see its fulfillment in the messianic kingdom. So the name change from Baali to Ishi, and then all remembrance of Baal removed in verse 17. Now, let me note here that Jewish women in the kingdom will no longer address their husband by Baali. It's going to be taken out of the vocabulary. But this is future to us, because the word Baali is in use today in Israel. So this will be fulfilled. Verse 17 will be fulfilled in the kingdom. All right, we now come to point C, the restoration of security in the Messianic kingdom. Verse 18. In that day, the kingdom, I will also make a covenant with them, with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow and the sword and war from the land, and will make them lie down in safety. So there'll be no danger from the animal kingdom. Animals will cease to be man's enemies. And you know, Isaiah picks this up in Isaiah 11, verses 6 through 9. The wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Also the cow and the bear will graze, Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Isn't that a great picture? So the animal kingdom and the human kingdom will be at total peace and contentment with one another. So there'll be no damage from the animal kingdom. There'll be no damage or destruction by war. Men will cease to be enemies. You know, and Micah said the same thing in Micah 4:3. Micah said, "And he will judge between many peoples and render decisions for mighty distant nations. Then they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war." And you know, this is one of my favorite verses because I spent 3 years in the U.S. Army and I was trained for war. And there I am with my helicopter in the Republic of South Vietnam. I was a helicopter crew chief and mechanic with the 101st Airborne Division. And so I was trained for war. I was trained in basic training. And of course, my helicopter had a gun platform that could be attached to it. And although I was very grateful, it was never attached to my ship when I was the crew chief on it. So I look forward to the day when young men are no longer trained for war. All right, now we come to verses 19 and 20 and the betrothal. And the word betrothed is used three times, emphasizing three different facets of the remarriage. Here's Hosea 2:19 and 20. "I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in loving kindness and in compassion. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know the Lord." So this is nicely divided up into three parts. The first betrothal is in regard to time in verse 19. Forever. There'll never be an estrangement between God and his Jewish people forever. In the kingdom, the glue will be permanent. Then the second aspect of the second betrothal is in regard to content, similar to the bride price that you have to pay for your bride, that the content is righteousness. Righteousness is conformity to God's standards of behavior, living by a standard of behavior. The second betrothal includes justice. Justice, in a sentence, consists of safeguarding the rights of others. And so these are both legal standards. So all legal standards for the betrothal will be met. Then the next aspect of the content is loving kindness. The word there is chesed, loyal love, steadfast love, covenant love. And the not only loving kindness, but mercy. The word there is barachamim. Again, racham, womb love. Mercy means compassion, interest in the special needs of the poor and the needy, the way a mother has compassion upon the child of her womb. So all emotional standards for the betrothal are now met. These are all emotion words, loving kindness and mercy. So all legal standards for the betrothal have been met. All emotional standards for the betrothal are met. And then comes the third aspect, which focuses in on quality. Quality is the emphasis in verse 20. The first quality mentioned is faithfulness. What does faithfulness mean? It means dependability and devotion. So all fidelity standards for the betrothal will be met as well. Legal standards, emotional standards, and fidelity standards all met. And the result, point four at the bottom of your page, they will know the Lord. Now that Hebrew word know is used for the most intimate of relationships. Israel will experience a deep personal intimacy with God, an intimacy like marriage. And that's a common picture throughout the Tanakh. And all this will be based on the new covenant of Jeremiah 31:31-34. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." So the entire nation, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, will be part of the new covenant. But it's not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. So here's a reference to the Mosaic covenant. The new covenant is very different from the Mosaic covenant. The Mosaic covenant, right here it states, was broken. But here's the contrast. This is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them. The law will no longer be external. I will put my law within them. And on their heart I will write it. And I will be their God. And they shall be my people. So on every individual Jewish person's heart, the law of God is going to be written. That's very different from the Mosaic law, which was written on tablets of stone. They will not teach again each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. Notice the emphasis on the individual. Every individual, from the most prominent person to the most humble person, will know the Lord. We won't have to teach Jewish people anything anymore. I'll be out of a job, out of a job. And here's the basis. The basis for this, I will forgive their iniquity and their sin. I will remember no more. And that's the focus of the new covenant. Individual salvation from sin brings these incredible results. So Israel, oh, by the way, yes, Luke 22:20, Yeshua instituted the new covenant for those who believe in him, whether they be Jew or Gentile. For those who trust in him, individuals can enter into the new covenant by faith. In the same way, he took the cup after they had eaten, saying, This cup, which is poured out for you, is the new covenant in my blood. So the new covenant is instituted in 30 AD at Passover. This is the portal through which the Gentile believer enters into the place of blessing. The place of blessing is the Abrahamic covenant. The Gentile believer enters in through the new covenant because individuals, Jew or Gentile alike, can get their sins forgiven through individual faith in Yeshua. And that's the essence of the new covenant, individual salvation from sin. All right, so Israel will now gain true spiritual knowledge. I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend anybody, but not the knowledge of the rabbis. True spiritual knowledge found from the Tanakh. Israel will now gain true spiritual knowledge that leads to the reversal of the names of Hosea's children. And now the names of these kids are going to be changed in verses 21 through 23. It will come about in that day that I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the heavens, and they will respond to the earth, and the earth will respond to the grain, to the new wine, and to the oil. And they will respond to Jezreel. And I will sow her for myself in the land. I will also have compassion on her who had not obtained compassion. And I will say to those who were not my people, You are my people. And they will say, You are my God. So again, the Lord makes a solemn declaration, a Ne'um Adonai, a solemn declaration that these names are going to be changed. Jezreel will be now used in the sense of sowing, instead of in the sense of scattering. The thought is now sowing in the land. God sows a sinister meaning, God scatters, is now transformed into a blessed meaning, God sows. And then he talks about the fruitfulness with cooperation between the heavens and the earth and the produce. So this is a quick glance at the abundance which will characterize the Messianic kingdom. And the Sanchino Books of the Bible and the Art School Tanakh has some nice comments in regard to the fruitfulness and cooperation between the heavens, earth, and the produce. They are all personified as the effects of individuals, as though they were individuals. Here's what the Sanchino Books of the Bible says on verse 23. I will respond to the heavens. The earth will not sigh in vain for the rains of heaven, which will no longer be withheld. All nature will work in perfect harmony. Heaven and earth are here personified as standing in need of each other's cooperation, but alike dependent upon God. Nice statements. And here, on verse 23 from the Archkol Tanakh commentary. In describing the prosperity which will exist at that time, the prophet turns his focus now upon the process of growth which brings about the promised abundance of produce. He depicts the process as if it were achieved by the willful efforts of its factors through personification. With each step of the process, turning to the one that precedes it and requesting its support. Thus, the people who benefit from the crops turn to the produce itself and seek the sustenance it provides. The crops, in turn, are dependent upon the earth in which they grow, and thus they seek their subsistence from that land. However, the earth cannot yield its fruits without the rain, so it raises its eyes heavenward and begs for rain. The heavens themselves can only give rain by decree of the Almighty, so they turn to Him in supplication. In order to provide the people with food, each of these factors must respond positively to the one that depends upon it. So the wonderful, God's wonderful process of providing for the physical needs of mankind is laid out in verse 23 in a beautiful way. So Ruchamah in the, excuse me, that was in verse 22, laid out in verse, well, I guess that is verse 23, excuse me. All right, so that's a quick look at the abundance in the Messianic Kingdom. By the way, verses 21 and 22 are recited when putting on tefillin. Now, what is a tefillin? Well, the source for the practice of tefillin is Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 8. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down. And when you rise up, you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. So here is a Israeli Jewish soldier wearing tefillin and praying. Now here is armed tefillin. You see the box over his bicep? That box is on the left arm, so it's close to the heart. And that little box contains sections of scripture, and they're bound to his arm and hand very securely. So that's the arm tefillin. You'll bind it to your hand. And then there's the head tefillin, and you see he's wearing this little box on his forehead. And again, that little box contains sections of scripture. And so it is bound as a frontlet between his eyes. So this is the rabbinic practice of arm tefillin and head tefillin. And the verses 21 and 22 recited before putting on those prayer items. All right, second part of verse 23. The nation will now be called Ruchamah instead of Lo Ruchamah. Israel will obtain mercy instead of no mercy. And then in the last part of verse 23, Israel will be called Ami instead of Lo Ami. You are my people instead of not my people. And the very, very last word of verse 23 is Elohai. You are my God. You are my God. The last phrase of the chapter, this is Israel's declaration of repentance and faith. Very important chapter there. All right, now if you look at page 10 on your handouts PDF, you'll get a comparison chart of chapters 1 and 2. This just puts the two chapters side by side so you can see them summarized in parallel columns. So in verses 1 through 7, the theme was judgment and the time frame was Hosea's day. Likewise, in chapter 2, verses 2 through 13, the theme is judgment, also in Hosea's day. Then in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 1, the theme is judgment, but this is the Lo Ami period, beginning in 30 AD until the second coming. But then in chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, again, the theme is judgment, but this is judgment during the tribulation period, not during the Lo Ami period. They're at the very end of the Lo Ami period. And then in verses 10 through Chapter 1, verse 10 through chapter 2, verse 1, the theme changes to restoration. Restoration and the glory in the Messianic Kingdom. And again, in chapter 2, verses 16 through 23, the whole theme resorts back to restoration. Restoration in the Messianic Kingdom. So chapters 1 and chapter 2 are very, very important chapters to understand in the book of Hosea. These give you an overview of God's relationship with Israel from the past, way back in Hosea's day, into the future kingdom. Now, between chapter 2 of Hosea and chapter 3, some intervening events have occurred. Gomer has played the harlot after her marriage to Hosea. Now, at this point, she is now guilty of adultery. It appears that she even left Hosea. She left him to chase after her partners, to chase after her customers. And eventually, her adulterers, her partners, sold her into slavery. So after she's sold into slavery, a second commission comes to Hosea. He's to go out and to purchase her out of the slave market. So now we go in our time frame. We were in the kingdom in verses 16 through 23. Now we jump all the way back to the left-hand column of the chart, all the way back to the prophet's present time, 781 BC, in chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. So this is your time frame chart, which is in page 4 of your Hosea handouts. So we have a second commission coming to Hosea in verses 1 through 3. So the first part of the commission itself is in the first part of verse 1. Hosea chapter 3, verse 1. Then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress. So Hosea loved her, didn't he? Gomer is now an adulteress. She's now sold into slavery. Her husband is called Areya, a friend. This is a tender term for a husband. It means companion, friend. It's used that way in Jeremiah 3 and Song of Solomon 5. On your outline, you can see some cross-references. So Hosea is commissioned to take her back and to love her still. Then the application is in the second half of verse 1. Hosea is to do that, and he's to picture the Lord. Even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. So that's the application to the nation. What's going on in Hosea's marriage is parallel to what's going on in the nation. God still loves Israel. He's Israel's friend. He's Israel's companion in spite of her loving other gods. And that's a G with a small g. In other words, idols. Now, this reference to raisin cakes is a reference to some of the idolatrous practices that were going on. They were symbols of erotic passion. For example, in the Song of Solomon, but they were used in the worship of the idols. So there was erotic worship going on with this false religion. And that's laid out in Jeremiah 7 and Jeremiah 44. So this is a figure of speech for indulging in sensuality, especially religious sensuality. Now, please note as you read verse 1, note well that God loves Israel in spite of her sin. Even while she is sinning, he still loves her. Now, he will discipline his beloved, but he will never reject her. And again, this is in contrast to replacement theology, which teaches that the Jewish people have sinned against God, therefore he has rejected them and replaced them with the church. I'm sorry, that is not the message of Hosea chapter 3, verse 1. All right, let's move on to verse 2, and we see that Hosea will obey the commission, and in verse 2, he purchases Gomer. So I bought her for myself. This is out of the slave market. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. So the price in coinage, so to speak, 15 pieces of silver, but there was another aspect to the price, 1.5 homers of barley. And well, that was equal to another 15 pieces of silver. Now, barley was a food generally despised in antiquity. It was the food of animals, of slaves, of the very, very poor. But did you notice the total? 15 pieces of silver and a homer and a half of barley equals another 15 pieces of silver, so we have a total of 30 pieces of silver. Why is this important? Because this is the price of a dead slave. Exodus 21:32. A dead slave. It is a very, very low price. So she, Gomer, had been utterly used up. She's utterly wasted. She's utterly debauched. She'd been sold into slavery. but her worth was that of a dead slave. She was very worthless to her owners. She was totally degraded. She was a poor specimen of a slave and of a woman. And I thought this illustration illustrated her plight very well, looking out around a corner, tears and dirt and filth in her eyes. She is totally debauched and useless as a slave, and probably as a woman as well. Very sad situation for Gomer to be in, that she put herself in. So in verse 3, we now come to the deprivation of Gomer. Verse 3. Then I said to her, "You shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be toward you." So they won't abide. They will abide without two things. First of all, she won't play the harlot, so no adultery. But she also won't play the wife. There'll be no conjugal opportunities. And Hosea will be the same with her. So for many days, they will experience a platonic relationship, no intimacy, but they will be faithful to that relationship. They will be faithful to that new state of affairs. And let me suggest here that because Hosea still loved Gomer very tenderly, I suggest that he very carefully and tenderly nursed her back to health during this time when they had to have a platonic relationship. She probably needed the nursing care. All right. Now, as we get to verses 4 and 5, we jump back again, back to the future. In verses 1 through 3, we're in the prophet's present time. But now we jump all the way forward, thousands of years future to us, in the tribulation period in verse 4. And we now look at the application to the wife of the Lord. And again, restoration is the key here. So let's take a look at verse 4, which speaks about the many days of deprivation. And this, of course, you see the application to the nation here, the application of Hosea's family life to the nation. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols. So the nation for many days will not have a king or a prince. They will not have civil authority. We lost our king after the Babylonian destruction. We lost our prince after the Roman destruction. And we wandered around the face of the earth for 2,000 years without any civil authority, under the civil authority of whatever nation we happen to be residing in. And that was true until the reformation of the nation of Israel in 1948. Many days of deprivation without sacrifice or ephod. So there'll be no true worship of the Lord. No true worship of the Lord during this time. There'll be no sacrifice. That means there's no temple. You know, you can't sacrifice without the temple. So there's no sacrifice going on even today. And there's no ephod. Well, that means that there's no priesthood to officiate in the temple. Now, what is an ephod? You may not be familiar with the term. Well, there's a number of two major opinions regarding the way the high priest's garments appeared, how they were constructed. And at the Temple Institute, you can see these renditions. Here is the high priest's garments according to the Jewish commentator Maimonides. So Maimonides would picture them this way. And the ephod is this vest. This purple vest that the high priest is wearing here, that the breastplate is attached to. So that would be Maimonides' opinion of the ephod, that vest around on the shoulders and around the trunk of the high priest. But, you know, you get one Jew together, you get two opinions, right? Two Jews, three opinions. Anyway, here's the high priest's garments according to the Jewish commentator Rashi. And the ephod is this apron-like garment going around the waist of the high priest, and then the suspenders at the back, and the breastplate is attached to the high priest's chest the same way. So this is another option for the ephod, that multicolored garment there. So there'll be no priesthood, but you know the Well, let me go on to the third aspect, the third deprivation. So there's no king and prince, there's no sacrifice and ephod, there's no pillar and teraphim. That also means there's no false worship of idolatry. So Israel will not practice idolatry during this period, although it's back in the land now. Pillar is a reference to temple gods, and teraphim a reference to household gods. So Israel will be in kind of a in-between state. And this is certainly Israel's condition today. The Jewish people are in an in-between state as a result of Jezreel, God's scattering for many days. And that many days now stretches out over 2,000 years. That's 730,000 days. But you know, those days may be coming to an end because there is a constant pressure to rebuild the temple. Now, the temple that gets rebuilt will be the third temple, which will be the tribulation temple. Unfortunately, the rabbis do not have the or reject the data from the New Testament. So as they put pressure on the government to rebuild the temple, it's the third temple, the temple that will be desecrated by the Antichrist. They think it is the Messianic temple, but it is not. It is the tribulation temple. And if you go to the Temple Institute, you'll see the golden altar of incense that they have put together for use in the holy place in the temple. And this is not a museum piece. They expect to use this altar in worship in the temple. They put together the necessary accoutrements for worship. This is a golden flask, probably for pouring out water or a wine offering. And here is an incense chalice for the incense offering to hold the powdered incense. They've put together musical instruments, for example, a lyre like this lyre, this harp-like instrument. And this is the laver, the copper laver, for the priests to use for purification, for washing themselves. You can see this at the Temple Institute. The menorah that will go in the holy place has been constructed as well. This is the temple menorah. And then this is the breastplate that the high priest will wear as he wears his garments and officiates in the temple. And finally, the Temple Institute is even busy fitting Levitical garments. They're able to pinpoint Levites through the a gene signature that only Levites have. And so they are identifying Levites and beginning to train and clothe them for work in the temple. But let me emphasize, this will be the third temple, the tribulation temple, not the fourth temple, which is the Messianic temple in the Messianic kingdom. All right, now let's take a look at verse 5 of chapter 3, which speaks of the restoration. We have the many days of deprivation in verse 4, and now the restoration in verse 5. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. So afterward, after this period of many days, into the latter days, Israel will return. And not passively, but Israel will actively seek the Lord their God. That's the Messiah. So this is the end of the tribulation period. And David their king. Remember, David will be the co-regent over Israel because that government of Israel is stated as being Rosh Echad, one head. And that term Echad carries a strong meaning of compound unity. So David will be the co-regent with the Messiah. And we've looked at a number of cross-references regarding that as well. So Israel will actively seek this governmental system, and Israel will come with fear, with reverential awe to the Lord and to his goodness. And I'm going to share with you some cross references regarding all of this, and you can write these down. I'm not going to put them up on the slide. Isaiah 53 verses 1 through 9, that is coming trembling to the Messiah. Isaiah 53 verses 1 through 9. Then Romans 11, 25 through 27, that's all Israel being saved at the end of the tribulation period. Zechariah 12, 10 to 13, 9, that outlines the final plea of Israel, pleading for the Messiah to come. And Psalm 80, that is one of the psalms that record the pleas of Israel for the Messiah to come. So again, the cross references you can look at: Isaiah 53, 1 through 9, Romans 11, 25 through 27, Zechariah 12, 10 through 13, 9, and Psalm 80. And by the way, what is the rabbinic view of Hosea 3, 5? In the Talmud, Megillah 18a, we read this: "Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king." And so they're paraphrasing. Excuse me, let me back up there. They're in the Babylonian Talmud, they're paraphrasing or quoting Hosea chapter 3, verse 5. So it's seen, this is seen as a messianic verse. In Midrash Rabbah, Genesis: "Thus, in the messianic future," messianic times now, "Israel shall fear," that is, "and they shall come in fear unto the Lord and his goodness." Again, quoting Hosea chapter 3, verse 5. Targum Jonathan to the prophets: "After that, the children of Israel shall repent and seek the worship of the Lord their God." Again, it's seen as a messianic. "And they shall obey Messiah, the son of David, their king." So Israel will repent and come to the Lord and obey the Messiah. So again, it's seen as a messianic verse. "And he shall direct them to the worship of the Lord, and great shall be his goodness, which shall come to them at the end of days." So again, rabbinic view is that verse 5 is very, very, very messianic. All right, so we're on point E, a summary of these symbolic names. Point 1, the kingdom is destroyed and the nation scattered, Jezreel. The nation is without mercy, lo ruchamah, that's past, that's the Assyrian destruction. The nation will not be God's people, lo ami, that's the present, this is the temporary lo ami period. Point 4, but in the future Israel will be sown to the Lord, Jezreel. She will again become God's people, ami. She will again obtain mercy, ruchamah. So in the upcoming sections of Hosea, we will encounter an expansion of these basic ideas. And I'm going to repeat again because it bears repeating again. I'm sorry if you feel like I'm beating this into your head, but I have to. I'm going to repeat again that this flies in the face of replacement theology. The nation is disciplined, but never rejected and replaced by the church. It's just not going to happen. All right, now this chart, you'll find it on page 11 of your Hosea handouts. This is a heads up as to what we will encounter in chapters 4 and 5 of the book of Hosea. In chapter 4, it will be a near prophecy dealing with 722 BC and the Assyrian destruction of the nation. The recipients, Israel alone, that's the northern kingdom. And so the extent is devastation on the northern kingdom, but mercy on the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom of Judah was not destroyed by the Assyrians. And the result, though, is dispersion for the northern kingdom. But then as we get into into chapter 5, it is a far prophecy dealing with 70 AD. This is far, far down the road from Hosea's day. It was a destruction by Rome. The recipients of this judgment are Israel and Judah. So the extent is devastation on the entire nation this time, and the dispersion of the entire nation in the Lo Ami period, which we know now has lasted 2,000 years. All right. Well, we're nearing the end of our time, so let's begin in chapter 4, see how far we can get in chapter 4. So we have the message of Hosea's prophecies in chapter 4, verse 1 to 14:8, and point A deals with the sins of Israel in verses 1 through 19. God has a controversy with Israel in verses 1 through 5, so the announcement of the controversy is in the first part of verse 1. "Listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel, for the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land." That's the announcement of the controversy, the case. Second part of the verse: "Because there is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land." So there's a lack of righteousness. Now, the NASB translated the term there, faithfulness. It can also be translated truth. There's a lack of goodness, translated by the NASB as kindness. And there's a lack of knowledge, translated by the NASB as knowledge. So truth, faithfulness, goodness, kindness, knowledge is what is required to live by God's standard of righteousness. That's God's standard of righteousness. That's his plumb line. Truth, goodness, and knowledge. Faithfulness, kindness, and knowledge. But his plumb line was ignored. The law was broken in verse 2. Here's what's going on in the land. There is swearing, deception, murder, stealing, and adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. Now the focus here is on the Ten Commandments. Swearing, that's the third commandment, misusing the name of God. Second one, breaking faith, that's the ninth commandment, against false testimony. Killing, that's the sixth commandment, thou shalt not murder. Stealing, that's the eighth commandment, against thievery. Adultery, that's the seventh commandment, against sexual sins. So all these commandments are being broken willy-nilly, and the result is horrendous. The result is terrible. It's described as blood touching blood. Violence touching violence. That term blood there is a euphemism for a violent death. We use the term today, you know, his blood be upon your hands. His violent death is your responsibility. Okay? So we have violent deaths upon violent death. So violence and revenge are commonplace. It's a cycle, one causing the other. And the result of all this is judgment of the land. Judgment of the land in verse 3. Therefore the land mourns, and everyone who lives in it languishes, along with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky, and also the fish of the sea disappear. This is probably a reference to the curses of the Mosaic covenant. In Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, drought is a curse of the covenant. Here's the Leviticus 26 verse. This is one of the curses of breaking the Mosaic covenant. I will also break down your pride of power. I will also make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. The sky will be hard. No rain will come from it. The earth like bronze. It's dried up and hard and cracked. And then in Deuteronomy 28 verses 23 and 24, the heaven which is over your head shall be bronze. Again, that picture of hardness. No water coming down. And the earth which is under you, iron. Again, that earth is the earth is dried and hard. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder and dust. So instead of water coming down to fructify the land will experience sandstorms. Dust storms. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder and dust from heaven. It shall come down on you until you are destroyed, until the famine destroys you. So that's the judgment on the land. All right, I see here we have less than 2 minutes remaining. So let's call it quits right there, and we'll pick it up at point E on your outline. God's controversy with Israel. He announces his controversy, he gives the reasons for his controversy, and then he gives the content, the breaking of the law, and the results of breaking the law, which will all bring about judgment on the land. All right, we'll pick it up then next session with verse 4 of Hosea chapter 4. So thanks for joining us. Shalom.